This is Climate Justice Radio. Before we dive into our topic for today, we want to talk about our land story, a format where we personally reflect on our relationship to the land and Indigenous peoples to confront colonial histories. Melissa and I grew up in the same neighborhood of Mississauga, the traditional territory of the Anishinaabek, Huron-Wendat, Haudenosaunee, and Ojibwe and Chippewa peoples, the land that is home to the Métis and most recently the territory of the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, who are direct descendants of the Mississaugas of the Credit. Our relationship with Canada started when our parents immigrated from Hong Kong in the 1980s. This would have been impossible before 1962 due to the Chinese Exclusion Act passed in 1923 that prohibited Chinese immigration to Canada, and before that, the Chinese Immigration Act of 1885 that put a head tax on immigrants despite using them for hard labor to build the Canadian Pacific Railway. The legacy of this history is still apparent today, as we saw with COVID-19 and the increase in anti-Asian hate crimes. Thanks for listening to our land story. Now I'm going to introduce our guest, Melissa Poon. Melissa is an architectural designer currently working for Moriyama and Toshima Architects, who has a deep interest in regenerative and circular design. She's exploring the ways in which the built environment and its occupants can operate in symbiosis with nature. She completed her master's thesis on this topic, and she would love to share more about this topic with us. So welcome to the podcast, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Excited to have you here. So first things first, let's define for our listeners, what exactly is regenerative architecture?
So regenerative architecture, it's the notion that built environments would be able to provide more than what they consume. So then in a broad sense, it's about making things actually good and not just less bad, as many buildings constructed are being built today.
So when you say like good and not less bad, what exactly does that mean? So what are some examples of things that could be like positive versus just like reducing harm?
There's a concept of sustainability, and then there's a concept of regenerative design. And sustainability is reducing the amount of negative effects that the construction industry is having on the environment, whereas regenerative design is about actually instilling more good into the ecosystem and to the well-being of the occupants, and actually operating to reverse the damage and do things like, for example, generating and storing energy on site for the surrounding communities, cleaning stormwater runoff directly on site, and, you know, like have like their facades could even like scrub the air. So regeneration is not simply sustainability and using fewer resources, but it's about replenishing and bettering our environment.
That's a great distinction. I don't know if I would have thought about it like that. You also mentioned in your thesis, one way to take regenerative architecture further is to push on this concept of living in symbiosis with nature. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means?
Yeah, of course. Symbiosis, like the concept of symbiosis, is basically a beneficial interaction between two different parties or individuals. And an example of this would be that's found in nature is bees and flowers, or like clownfish and an anemone. And these are just mutualistic relationships that have occurred in nature for like millennia. So in borrowing this concept of symbiosis, it's how we could perhaps take the built environment and the natural ecosystems to not only coexist, but to operate for the benefit of the other.
That's really interesting. I love this idea that our buildings are not just static, but alive with our environments and with nature. Can we go a little deeper into what symbiotic architecture means and why we think it's so important to advocate for today?
I mean, something that maybe we could like talk about first is like our modern perception of what nature is. Because I feel like we often view nature as something other, you know, something to be dominated or destroyed. Or, you know, for many of us during COVID, like some sort of faraway untouched land that we could like visit in the mountains and forests. But nature really is not really just an idyllic scene, but it's a, we should really acknowledge it as the planetary like life support system that it truly is. I mean, we can't survive like a few minutes without oxygen, and we obviously need all the land and water to provide us with like the vegetables, fruit, water that we drink. This relationship that we have with this life support system, you know, it is under threat with increasing rates of urbanization and, you know, the times that we increasingly spend with our electronic devices. So trying to dissolve like what we think of as us and nature is kind of essential in a way to address the climate crisis, is to reestablish and reintroduce a renewed and regenerative relationship and understanding of our place on the planet and with each other.
Yeah, I love this idea that if we change our story about our relationship to nature, we can really help change a lot. Is there anything else that we can do?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's not only, you know, important for like industry leaders to be more engaged in this discussion, but, you know, especially to the public, like to our listeners right now, we'd actually be using these spaces and living in our cities. It's important to become like more aware of like our immediate surroundings, whether built or natural, and how they affect us and our well-being, and how our own activities and mentalities would shape and impact the places that we, you know, inhabit daily in all aspects, you know, mentally, physically, and socially.
That's so interesting. Could we maybe dive into some of the implications of our built environment and how they do impact us once we gain some of this awareness?
So, I mean, there's like a lot of like implications from that and a lot of different considerations. But one of the things that I think is not really widely known is how much human health is being impacted by our impact on ecological systems. Some of these studies are showing that our health, you know, really depends on the planet's health, and that, you know, it affects us directly, you know, through heat waves, stronger storms, flooding, or like, you know, indirectly through air pollution, disease, and contamination. And buildings, these shelters we create, you know, are really only for our current generation, but for, you know, all that come after us.
Thanks for sharing that with us. I think those are all examples of really great reasons why we should move more in the direction of making our architecture more symbiotic with nature. So how should we change the industry? Like, what are some things that we should do next?
I mean, so some of the things that we could hope to change is perhaps first, you know, an adaptation of this like mindset shift, but also, you know, an acknowledgement like we can't really do anything in modern society without really damaging the planet in some ways. Like, we can't get anywhere without cars, and we can't really skip buying food without plastic packaging in it. And another sense, like the architectural and planning industries really aren't exempt from this. The need to change the way that we live and construct is becoming increasingly imperative. And, you know, the industries have become rather, you know, extractive and destructive in nature. So then there's a concept, I mean, that I'd want to propose, like, that, like, you know, our built environments, like, they have this kind of clear distinction between the inside and the outside. So the question here could be, like, if we can dissolve that boundary. So it's essentially dissolving that boundary between the natural and the artificial. And, like, if you observe nature closely, you'll actually notice that ecologies, like, everywhere, they function in this kind of closed circular loop where, you know, waste becomes nutrient and decay makes way for life. There's actually this, like, inherent and intrinsic intelligence of natural ecologies that, you know, like, scientists are recently uncovering. The question here is, like, if we can apply this new understanding of nature to the way that we design and fabricate the built environment, we wouldn't necessarily have to return to a lifestyle, you know, similar to our ancestors. But by, you know, utilizing all of our technological innovations we have today and merging it with this new understanding of intelligence in nature, it could be the way to continue the growth and well-being of, you know, both ecosystem and humanity, and potentially, you know, reinstate this symbiotic coexistence with nature.
So could you dive into maybe why the architecture and construction industry today is not really in symbiosis with nature, or how it might be harming our environment?
Something I think is also not largely known is that the architectural and construction industry actually contributes to about 40% of carbon emissions worldwide. And I mean, part of it is from building materials and construction, but the other part is to, you know, heat, cool, light, and cook and power buildings. And, you know, most of that is also from fossil fuels. There's an acknowledgement that, like, we adopt these energy efficient measures, but we overlook this kind of root cause of energy addiction, which is our separation from nature.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's actually quite a bit we can do and reform in our current industry to make constructing buildings a little bit more environmentally sound. Are there any existing techniques today that we could leverage?
Yeah, of course. There's the idea that connecting to nature, like in the built environment, is actually rather clear and is actually a pretty ancient concept. it's actually been the only way that like humankind has only knew how to build for like really for thousands of years. And it's, you know, it's called vernacular architecture. And it's basically a way of building in a way that emerges in response to like the unique climate, ecology, culture, and community of its specific location. The way that the indigenous have built, their homes have been, and their buildings have been heated and cooled naturally. And they kind of embrace the sort of natural breezes and sunshine of the area to heat, cool, and light the space to make their habitats comfortable. And they've been doing this for hundreds of years, for millennia, really. The techniques that were used were rather like, they were ingenious, but they were rather simple and mostly passive. For instance, like in desert climates, they simply use the evaporation of water to cool spaces, like through openings in terracotta walls, or even through like large wind towers that they would construct. Essentially, in both functionality and aesthetically, these buildings became an expression of the people and were unique to their place.
Yeah, wow. So it sounds like there's actually a lot we can learn from history. Is there anything that we can do today to like leverage some of these techniques or something different to make our current cities more sustainable or our new future buildings more sustainable?
So on an urban scale, there's a concept that's called smart cities, and it's basically if a city were to be building a new, entirely new portion of the city, they could create something that's called smart city, and it's basically to integrate like technology, you know, in all levels of urban infrastructure and public communication, and instill that in things like traffic and public transportation systems, and waste, water management, in hospitals and schools. And in order to, you know, improve efficiency of operations across the city, essentially this this kind of smart city would reorient the city away from cars and return it to pedestrians and trees, and to integrate regeneratively designed buildings. There's actually one in construction right now in Toronto. It's called Villiers Island, and it's by the Portlands. If you drive by Queen's Quay, you'll just see it, everything under there in under construction. But, you know, this kind of concept, like, it is a work in progress. And, you know, a lot of it does seem to be, you know, contingent on government engagement and funding.
And what about on a smaller scale? So within the architecture industry itself, any standards for building actual buildings?
Yeah, so then on the architectural, like the building scale, there's something that's called LEED certification. And it measures the sustainability of a building. So it's been pretty like well established in the industry now, but LEED is basically, it stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And there's like various levels that you can achieve based on like how sustainable or how many sustainability metrics the building can integrate. And for instance, like the building that I live in is considered a LEED Gold. And what that means is that it integrates like sustainability measures such as efficient water and energy use, optimized daylighting and indoor quality, and like the use of renewable energy. It would be, I would think, the first step in the industry toward a more sustainable way of building. But I find that it's only like really focused on the reduction of negative environmental impacts caused by the built environment. And there's actually something else that's emerging that takes it a step further, and that's called the Living Building Challenge.
Oh, that's really interesting. Could you tell me a little bit more about what the Living Building Challenge is?
Yeah, so the Living Building Challenge, it's another form of certification, but, you know, it is based on regeneration and basically creating buildings that can reanimate and, like, renew the environment for both, like, the natural world and human communities. The idea is that they'd be able to, for instance, generate more energy than renewables that they use. They could even grow food, incorporate biophilic design, collect and treat all water on site, essentially became self-sufficient and remain within like the resource limits of their sites, as opposed to, you know, extracting from places like super far away to get their resources.
That's really interesting. Would an example of something like this be, for example, a community garden or something on a roof?
Yeah, that could be definitely one of the aspects that could be integrated. So that's actually what you're mentioning is called a green roof. They're starting to be implemented in more buildings around the world. We could definitely do with a lot more because green roofs, they would basically reduce the temperature of a building and protect it, the roof from UV, and potentially provide like community gardening and integrate or invite more biodiversity directly in the city. There's something called heat urban island effect. The idea is that basically all this concrete and asphalt we have and all these hardscapes that we have in the city and these hard surfaces are absorbing all the solar radiation and keeping the heat trapped in even for hours after the sun sets. And obviously that's not beneficial for anyone in the city. And by implementing green roofs, we have all this horizontal real estate that we can essentially return back to nature for the benefit of both, you know, human occupants, individuals, and for other living beings and for the planet at large.
So are there examples of these living buildings out there in the world today?
There's actually only about like 350 of these buildings in various stages of certification today. So they're kind of scattered throughout North America, I believe. Given how big the world is, 350 is not a lot, so there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, certainly. It sounds like there's actually a lot of opportunity for more buildings to have this sustainable approach. To clarify one thing, would the Living Building Challenge or living buildings be considered a part of the umbrella of regenerative architecture?
Living Building Challenge, I guess, is the industry's kind of approach to what regenerative design could be. But basically, you know, what, as I mentioned before, it is creating more than the building consumes. So creating more inputs, outputs versus inputs.
Can you maybe clarify for us what you mean by inputs versus outputs here?
Yeah, of course. An input would, for example, could be like the construction of the actual building itself. One of the ways is to limit its growth. It's like you're only allowed to, for example, build on a previously developed site and not on any virgin land. You're not allowed to, for instance, use materials with toxic materials or chemicals in it. It would be highly suggested to use local materials. And if it were to be in timber, that would be approved by the Forest Stewardship Council. So that's a construction kind of side of how extractive a building can be and what a regenerative or what a living building can do about it. But there's also, you know, the operational side of it where what I mentioned earlier, how it could create more than it consumes. So something like that would be creating more creating more energy on site than it consumes.
So does that look like, for example, adding solar panels to a building?
Yeah, exactly. So it's about using the renewable energy technology that we have today, which does come in the form of solar panels. But there's also like the wind energy and all other forms of renewable energy that could be drawn directly on site, but also from perhaps like the local power grid. And the idea is to create more of that energy directly on site and then be able to contribute to communities.
So it sounds like also whenever we construct things, we do have to extract something from the environment. So we can't totally be non-extractive in our construction process. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's definitely that kind of aspect. Like we do have to acknowledge that, you know, everything, all the built environments, the materials that are used to construct them do come from the land and are like borrowed in essence. Yeah, that's a hard question because I mean, I feel like there's always going to be a level of extraction because that's just the way the current industry is building at least. So then there's a lot of initiative that needs to be taken to find alternative material sourcing, and there's a whole like field of material science, which is actually seeking to see how, like, you know, vernacular architecture was built with, like, say, like the earth and the clay that they had on site in the local kind of environment that they're in, and to not have to, you know, like pour concrete and like ship it like halfway across the world or ship steel around the world. There are definitely alternatives that are trying to be found today, and I think every industry leader or everyone in the industry should be advocating for that.
So it sounds like a really great vision. Is there a reason why today not more of our buildings are, for example, living building certified or under this regenerative architecture umbrella?
So living buildings, I think they're like a vision of what regenerative architecture should be. And it's like a really great step in the industry towards achieving what regenerative design can be. But it is still, I find, like a niche in the industry. There's a whole point in like trying to be able to find clients and designers who are willing to try something new and to take that step forward. If the budget allows for it, it's becoming more economically feasible. And, you know, the question of regenerative architecture, it is a vision. it's definitely still a work in progress. There's a lot that the industry has already identified as like unsustainable and destructive, and this is kind of the first step towards that. And I think whatever is being established with living buildings now is just encouraging and inspiring, because that just means that we can continue to build forward and better the standard and make it more applicable globally.
So how can we make this more of a reality for Toronto or for the world today?
So I think one of the most powerful things that we can do, both in the industry and individually, is that there could be like a societal shift in our perception of the built environment, a shift in our mindset, essentially. I mean, the way that we're building now is unsustainable. So perhaps one of the best ways we can go about it is to embrace a sort of regenerative mindset. Structures that we build are human habitats, that they're ecosystems made for us by us. And in the industry, like individuals, we need to take responsibility or be open to trying something new and to demand change, or especially political change, like where policies are involved, to take a stronger stance on that. And like, I know, like for projects that I've worked on, like that when economies like don't allow for that, design innovation is the key to all of this. Perhaps another thing I would say is like to be even more aware, become more aware of your immediate surroundings, and like how it's affecting you, like your own bedroom, your kitchen, living space, offices. Is there any way that you can imagine them differently, or to be more cognizant of perhaps like when, like, you know, a room is like dimly lit, or like you don't have enough access to airflow? It doesn't have to be that way. Your well-being is actually a lot more contingent on your immediate surroundings than you might think, and that architects, designers, like we have the ability to help every individual in every space that they inhabit to flourish.
So you mentioned one thing that's really interesting, which might be economies allowing for living buildings to exist. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing, because I mean, something like regenerative building or like a living building, it does require a certain amount of upfront investment, and they need like clients who would have like a long-term view on returns. But then, you know, like with incentives and policy changes that are happening and like a growing bunch of experts, there are just hurdles that can be overcome. And there's actually been a lot of numerous positive regulatory changes that have been made. But in cities like Toronto, the industry is really dominated by economic restraints and developers. Basically, there's almost like a singular focus on maximizing square footage and return on investment. So it unfortunately, you know, leaves no room to consider and acknowledge the fact that human beings would be occupying these spaces for years and decades to come. Perhaps the way to break through the status quo is to reclaim the fact that, you know, buildings are rightfully human habitats.
So one more thing before we end off. If we were to have these living buildings or regenerative architecture be a part of our everyday lives, what does that feel like for us?
Here's a little like thought experiment. Like, imagine yourself sitting in an office, perhaps like in the show The Office, fluorescent lighting, really small windows, and it's kind of stuffy, and you're like next to this person that smells really bad. Versus, for example, a room that's filled with dappled light and shadows. You can feel the breeze on your skin, hear the sound of birds and the rustling of trees when you're inside. Which one would you rather be in, right? Would you rather be in that kind of office space, or, you know, an indoor space that could make you feel vibrant and healthy as you do when you're outside?
I think that's a great point. I know which I would certainly prefer. Thank you so much, Melissa, for sharing with us this inspiring vision of regenerative architecture and how that could impact us, not only in helping solve the climate crisis, but also just making our everyday lives feel a little bit more pleasant. Thank you so much for taking the time. It was great speaking with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I had a great time. I'm Freya.
And I'm Chloe.
Welcome to our segment called Temp Check. This is where we'll give you the rundown of current events in our community, powerful movements around the world,
and a different call to action each episode for our listeners to participate.
For our February news, the Coastal GasLink pipeline, which is currently being built on sovereign and unceded Wet'suwet'en land without the consent of their hereditary chiefs, has faced a major setback this month. A group of unknown people stormed a worksite and destroyed millions of dollars worth of equipment, hopefully stalling the pipeline's construction. Many have condemned their violence, seeing as they threw smoke bombs and fire sticks when the RCMP arrived. But this could never compare to the violence of the RCMP, the state, and the corporations funding this doomed project.
We have two calls to action this week, and they are both mutual aid requests. The first is an ongoing fundraiser that's been created for a Gitxsan land defender and her son, and we need your help to reach our goal. These funds will go to ensuring this family can afford housing, food, medical care, and other living expenses. Through dealing with chronic pain, serious health issues, and intergenerational trauma, this land defender continues to fight against colonial oppression and advocate for Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit folks in their community. Let's redistribute our funds to help this family care for themselves and get some relief. You can donate through the link in our Instagram bio or at gofund.me/9899CFF5.
The second is a request from an Indigenous mother of five children who recently left an abusive relationship and is unable to find work. They urgently need support with rent and other living expenses. If you have any money lying around, especially if you're a settler, send it their way. Donations can be sent via e-transfer to topsey84, topsey84, at outlook.com with the password climate justice.
Hey folks, it's time to learn a song. The song is actually new to CJTO. It's called Everything to Gain by Allison Bayer and co-written with Devin Sprawl for Showing Up for Racial Justice. I first heard this song when I attended a white supremacy community conversation with Serge, and it struck me as a really beautiful way to begin a difficult conversation. My name is Danny, and I'm going to be teaching the song to Brooke and to all of you. Brooke, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So there's a really simple repeated verse and a short refrain. So we'll start by doing call and response for the verse. When you're healed, I'm healed.
When you're healed, I'm healed.
When you're whole, I'm whole.
When you're whole, I'm whole.
When you're safe, I'm safe.
When you're safe, I'm safe.
When you're free, I'm free.
When you're free, I'm free.
Okay, so that goes on for a bit longer. And then the refrain at the end of each verse is, we have everything to gain.
We have everything to gain.
Great. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
When you're healed, I'm healed. When you're whole, I'm whole. When you're safe, I'm safe. When you're free, I'm free. When you can breathe, I can breathe. When you win, I win. When you're fed, I'm fed. We have everything to gain.
When you're healed, I'm healed. When you're whole, I'm whole. When you're safe, I'm safe. When you're free, I'm free. When you can breathe, I can breathe. When you win, I win. When you feel respect, I feel respect. We have everything to gain.
When you're healed, I'm healed.
When you're whole, I'm whole.
When you're safe, I'm safe.
When you're free, I'm free.
Can breathe, I can breathe.
When you win, I win.
When you're home, I'm home.
We have everything to gain.
Yay! Thanks for doing that with me.
No problem. It was fun.
Climate Justice Radio is brought to you by Climate Justice Toronto. This episode featured original music and editing by Stephen Hegarat. I was your host for today's episode, with special guests Chloe Lederman and Freya doing our temp check, and Danny and Rebecca leading our sing-along. You can find all our socials and a link to sign up to join CJTO at our website, climatejusticeto.com. Information as well as other links mentioned in our podcast will be in our show notes. This episode was first aired on CJRU's Radio Everywhere program, which works in collaboration with community organizations to produce pieces that showcase the work they're doing and provide a platform to tell their own stories. You can find more about CJRU at cjru.ca/project/radio-everywhere. Remember to hit subscribe to be the first to be notified when we drop a new episode, and if you've enjoyed this podcast, feel free to leave a friendly review or share. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back.